Go to the book of Job. Job 29, we're continuing Job's final speech. It's not the last time we hear from Job, but it's the last thing he has to say to his friends. Closes out this section. Next week, we start a section, we hear from a new character, Elihu. Homework. Who's Elihu? There's some theories that get tossed about. Read ahead, see what you think. And then after that, we hear from God himself. And Job responds a little bit. God tells him maybe he didn't respond quite right. And Job will respond a whole lot better. We left off last week, the end of chapter 28, obviously. And it seemed like some things were coming together for Job. It seemed like some pieces were falling into place. Job was saying maybe it's not about understanding. Maybe it's about trusting. Maybe it's not about being able to explain what's going on. Maybe it's believing that God is in control of whatever's going on and that God, as we just reminded ourselves, is good. It's encouraging the way that Job has grown over these last 28 chapters. The thing is, it's not quite real for him yet. It takes time, just like it takes time for Christ to be formed in a new believer. You've seen that. You've experienced that. There are some things that are immediately, dramatically different when we come to Christ. There are some things that are a process. Sanctification is a progressive kind of a thing. It's a little bit, and it's a little bit, and a little bit, and then we lose some, and then we get it back by God's grace. Well, just like a person isn't all the way saved in one day, we're justified in a moment, sanctified through a lifetime, and then glorified when we see Jesus face to face. Job is in process. Job is a work in progress. He's realizing some things. He's articulating some things. He's not quite owning them yet. He walks right up to the line, and then he kind of slips back a little bit. Old ways of thinking, old ways of speaking. And that's what we're going to get tonight in chapters 29, 30, and 31. 29, he's going to be back talking about how good things used to be. He's going to talk about past blessings. Chapter 30, he's going to bemoan his present sufferings. Finally, in verse 31, he's going to look ahead a little bit defensively, maybe even a little aggressively, at his future standing. Does he have any hope? Chapter 29, verse 1, Job further continued his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness. The days that I walked by God's light rather than stumbling around in blackness, the good old days." The good old days weren't. You know that, right? Or at least not as good as we remember them. One person said, "The good old days are a function of bad memory and good imagination." To Job, it's real, though. Job is looking back and saying, "Everything was perfect then, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when God and I were close, when I felt like I heard from him before he bailed on me and left me to all of this, when my children were around me, the children that were taken by the storm that Satan brought. Verse 6, when my steps were bathed with cream and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me." Okay, he's getting a little bit over the top here. But in comparison, that's really what his life had been. He was a wealthy man, a prosperous man, with a loving family. Blessings flowed everywhere he looked. Everything financially, everything he touched seemed to turn to gold. He was a man of means and influence. Verse 7, when I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid. The aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. People my age, you remember the old ad campaign when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen? Yeah, Job was E.F. Hutton. When he talked, everybody said, "Shh, Job's got something to say. It's going to be good." That's what it was like to be Job, you know, before everything, before he was brought low. He was among the leaders of the city. He sat in the square, and people valued his counsel more than the counsel of the nobility. Verse 10, the voice of nobles was hushed. They knew better than to speak when Job was speaking. Their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. People listened to him. Even more than that, people liked him. Verse 11, when the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me. What did Job say that people heard and respected? What did he do that people saw and appreciated? Verse 12, well, they liked me because I delivered the poor who cried out. They respected me because I delivered the fatherless and the one who had no helper. Remember, Job's friends a couple different times have accused him of being cruel and ripping off the poor and being abusive to those less fortunate. Few worse offenses in Eastern culture than to abuse those who can't defend themselves. Job is saying, I wasn't that guy ever. I was the opposite of that guy. I helped the poor. I didn't hurt the poor. Verse 13, the blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. The elderly, the hospice patients, the widows, I blessed them, Job is saying, and they blessed me for helping them. They were grateful. They loved me. I put on righteousness and it clothed me, verse 14. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor. And I searched out the case that I did not know. Job said, I looked for people to help. I wasn't satisfied with the people who came to me. I went looking for them. Another possible way to read that last line, I made sure that the people I was helping really needed it. I was a good steward of the resources that God gave me. I used it to bless people who really needed the blessing. We try to do that here. People come to the church during the week on a regular basis. Hey, I need gas money to get to El Dorado. Hey, I need money for a motel. Hey, I need this. Most of the time, quite honestly, my answer is, I don't know you. I don't know your story. Well, let me tell you my story. Everybody's got a story. And you know, I pray and ask the Lord for discernment. But the truth is the resources that God has entrusted to us, we turn right around and use to bless the people in this body. We do what Job is talking about, searching out what we don't know. You know, we know each other. We're part of one another. That's part of community. We know that when we bless each other, we're using God's resources wisely and well. The person who comes up to the door, sometimes God says, against everything my eyes are telling me, yes, bless this person. And just because God is saying that, it doesn't mean that it's not a line. Sometimes it means that God says, yeah, it's a line, but bless him anyway, because grace. Job's point is that he was faithful and diligent, seeking those that he could bless and blessing those that he could. He didn't serve evil. He stood against evil. He saved people from evil. I broke the fangs of the wicked, verse 17, and plucked the victim from his teeth. And because Job did all that, he assumed he would be rewarded. He assumed that as he was blessing others, that he would be blessed in return. He assumed that the Beatles were right. The love that you make is equal to, never mind. He assumed that that's the way the universe worked. Verse 18, then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. He said, I was planning on dying in my sleep, dying in my bed of old age. I had a pastor friend tell me the other day, he was battling some health stuff. I called because it sounded like it could be serious. He says, no, I'm going to be here for a long time. One day I'm going to be in the middle of my Sunday service and I'm just going to drop dead. That's how I want to go, he said. I want God to call me home of a sudden aneurysm or coronary. I want to be dead before I hit the ground in the middle of preaching the gospel. And I said, you know, that would be really great for you. Traumatic for everybody else. Can you think of anything more disturbing? But what Job is finding out is we need to be careful imagining too far in the future. Jesus says, don't make promises for next year. We don't know what next year is going to bring. We don't know what next week is going to bring. I don't know how this service ends. We have plans, yes. Scripture tells us in Proverbs and elsewhere, yes, plan, but let God direct your steps. Make plans, not promises. My wife always says, New Year's Day doesn't know Christmas. There's always something that's going to be true in December that you can't possibly see in January. Job had no idea this was going to play out the way that it was. I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. That'd be nice. None of us can plan on that. None of us can plan that we're going to have the freedom to gather here in a few years the way that we do tonight. It was 3 years ago this summer, 3 years ago next month, in fact, that the Supreme Court handed down Obergefell v. Hodges that legalized same-sex marriage. And we looked at each other and we said, start the clock, because this begins the legal process of outlawing biblical Christianity. We've seen another step or on the horizon these past weeks with California. If what California is attempting to enact is becomes law and survives appeals and vetoes and so forth, it's going to be illegal to preach the full counsel of God. And this is with a Republican president and a Republican Congress. What does the future hold? We don't know. On the other hand, we can get paranoid. There's a generation of believers, some of you are in the room, who came of age in the 60s, who came to know Christ at the height of the Jesus movement. You read The Late Great Planet Earth and assumed that the rapture would be next Thursday. I know a lot of dear brothers and sisters who made decisions about life and marriage and ministry and college and finances, not thoughtfully or prayerfully so much as emotionally, based on Jesus is coming soon, really, really soon, next week soon. I remember what one Bible teacher said, Chuck Missler, who went home to the Lord last week. And I don't stand with everything that Chuck taught, especially later in his life and ministry, but he was a brilliant mind. With a military background, with a business background, as well as a ministry background. And he would say often, in the face of uncertainty, the best strategy is mobility. Don't get tied down to promises, in other words. Be careful of locking in commitment, because we don't know what God has in store. Verse 19, Job thought he did. He says, my root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. He's speaking in the past tense. He's expressing himself in the present tense, but he's still looking back at the good old days, and he's speaking of his virility here. He's already told us he was blessed with many children and blessed by his children. He's saying, and I could have had more. Back to the influence he had in his community, verse 21, he's saying to his friends, hey, you guys dismiss my perspective out of hand. You listen to what I have to say, and you shake your head and tell me that I'm full of animal crackers. But back in the day up to a few weeks ago, men listened to me, verse 21, and waited and kept silence for my counsel. And after my words, they didn't speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. They valued my opinion. They sought me out. They were refreshed by what I had to say. That's a rare gift. For that to be consistently true, I don't know that many people who can say that that's how they are experienced by most people most of the time. Because what Job is saying is more than, well, I only told people good things. Those are false prophets. Those are prosperity teachers. Those are shysters and hucksters. That's an easy way to get people to like you for a little while. Tell them what they want to hear. But clearly, Job was speaking wise counsel in 360 degrees of circumstances. He was speaking the truth in love, which had to include hard things, challenging things. I think it's a high compliment when somebody walks away from a conversation saying, man, that was tough to hear. That hurt a little bit. But man, I needed to hear it, and I'm glad someone spoke it to me. That's our goal. That's our calling. Speak the truth in love, Jesus says. So easy to say. People liked Job because he was a truth teller. But he was someone that people knew genuinely cared about them. They liked him because if Job mocked at them, verse 24, they didn't believe it. In the light of his countenance, they didn't cast down. He could kid with people. They'd know when he was kidding. And they'd know that he was kidding. They'd know when to take him seriously and when he was just being relational. Bottom line, verse 25, I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. Job was looking back and he's saying, I was a commander and a comforter. I was both of those things at the same time. But now none of that is true. And crossing over to chapter 30 now, shifting from past to present, he says, my current state, the way that you're finding me, experiencing me today, I couldn't be more different. But now they mock at me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock. To really understand the weight of what he just said, remember that age equaled respect in Job's culture, right? Remember that dogs were not pets. They were unclean and vile. And that people who tended flocks, shepherds, were at the low end of the totem pole, the social totem pole. Weren't allowed to participate in the political process, the judicial process. Their testimony was deemed unreliable in a court. They weren't allowed to testify. This is how far Job has fallen. He's saying, men I wouldn't hire to care for my shepherd's dogs have children who are making fun of me. That's low. Verse 2, Job says with more words, these guys are the bottom of the barrel. Indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? Their vigor has perished. They're gaunt from want and famine, fleeing late to the wilderness, desolate and waste, who pluck mallow by the bushes and broom tree roots for their food. They were driven out from among men. They shouted at them as a thief. They had to live in the clefts of the valleys, in caves of the earth and the rocks. Among the bushes they brayed, under the nettles they nestled. They were sons of fools, yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. They were run out of town. They were the worst of the worst. They were run out of town. In verse 9, now I'm their taunting song. They sing songs and make fun of me. That's how they pass their time, Job says, because Job's been run out of town too. Where is Job while all of this is going on? He's sitting on an ash heap, but that's a polite way of saying he's sitting on a dunghill, because the same pile they threw the sewage on, they also threw ashes from the fire over. Job is out there because, hey, you might be contagious. We need to quarantine you. We need to keep you away from people like a leper. And the only people who were around were the people who were run out of town because they were a danger to society. Other than the friends that came to comfort Job, by comfort, of course, we mean torment, his companions have been a mob of youth that Job compares to wild animals, which look at Job and they say, he's even worse than we are. Yes, I'm their byword, Job says. They abhor me, verse 10. They keep far from me, up to the point where they spit in my face, which was a worse insult in Job's day than it is in ours. Why do they do that? Because he, God, has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me. And because I'm so afflicted, they feel like they can pile on. They've cast off restraint before me. They think they can do whatever they want to me. At my right hand, the rabble arises. They push away my feet. They raise against me their ways of destruction. The image here is like laying siege to a city. They pile up earth and they build a ramp. And methodically comes their attack against me. They've made it their hobby to abuse Job. The picture I get, this is, I go back to fourth grade When I was fourth grade, there was a creek behind my elementary school, and there was a tree that had broken off halfway in a windstorm. The tree was hanging at a 90-degree angle, and it was splintered at the joint. And the fourth grade boys, we made it our mission, it was our purpose in life, to bring that tree down. And the things that we thought of, we threw rocks at it, we threw sticks at it. One friend of mine brought a toy bow and arrow set from home, or, you know, between a toy and a real one. We set arrows on fire and we shot flaming arrows at it. Couldn't get them to stick, but we shot fire at it. That's how serious we were. The last day of school, this is a true story, the last day of school, it came crashing down. That was the highlight of my life when I was in fourth grade. But that's how they are with Job, throwing sticks, throwing rocks, throwing flaming arrows, whatever they have. You've seen the same news reports I have, I'm sure, about packs of youth and sometimes not youth abusing the homeless in big cities because they can, because somehow that makes them feel better about themselves. That was what was going on here. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They have no helper. They come as broad breakers. He's shifting the metaphor. They come like a wave that crashes again and again and again and slowly wears me down. Under the ruinous storm, they roll along. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity is passed like a cloud. And now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night, and my gnawing pains take no rest. Every part of his body hurts. You know how you get really sick? Things that you didn't know that you had hurt. Things you didn't think could hurt, hurt. I know I'm sick when my eyes hurt, when my ears hurt. Not like earache, but like my ears. That every part of Job hurts. By great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as the collar of my coat. He's cast me into the mire. One way to understand that is to translate the word garment as skin. That's a valid way to translate the Hebrew. My skin is getting disfigured. My skin is starting to strangle me. Or another way to translate it, the New Living Translation renders those same verses. In his great power, God clutches at my clothing. He grabs me by the collar of my coat and thrusts me into the mud. Either way, not good, right? And either way, the hardest part of what Job is going through is God's silence while all of this is happening. God's apparent absence during these tribulations. I cry out to you, verse 20, but you don't answer me. He's like a child raising his hand in class. God, 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 nothing. And then I stand up and you regard me. The idea there is I stand up, I stand on my chair to get your attention, and you look at me with contempt. God feels like the enemy to Job. He says to God, "You've become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand, you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success. You pick me up and you throw me down." Job feels like he's going down for the last time. And the way I can tell is Job is saying, every time I have the slightest bit of hope, events conspire to take it away. The fact that Job thinks he's going down for the last time means he probably is. I remember Cale Mosley saying, you can live 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, 3 minutes without air, but only 3 seconds without hope. Job's pretty close to losing hope because he's looking around. He's saying, everything I touch turns to garbage. And God's not answering. And he says, verse 23, I know how the story ends. I know that you'll bring me to death, into the house appointed for all living. Death. Surely he will not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if they cry out when he destroys it. The way I know I'm going to die, Job says, no one else is speaking up for me. No one is asking God for mercy. and God's showing no signs of bringing mercy on his own. How is this fair? Verse 25. Have I not wept for him who is in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? But when I looked for good, evil came to me. When I waited for the light, then came darkness. My heart is in turmoil and cannot rest. Days of affliction confront me. I go about mourning, but not in the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry out for help, but I'm a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin grows black and falls from me. My bones burn with fever. My harp is turned to mourning, and my flute to the voice of those who weep. This is what's happening to me, says Job. And how is any of it fair? Because, he's going to tell us one more time, I haven't done anything to deserve any of it. He's talked about the past. He's reminded us of his present. Now he's going to end this section by saying, I'm staring at a brutal, nasty, very short future. And he's going to use that time to give us one last attempt to vindicate himself. He's going to recite crimes he didn't commit. Here's what I'm not guilty of. Here's what I haven't done. Chapter 31. I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? He's telling us he's not guilty of lust. Those of you who have ever wondered, the internet accountability and filtering software that many of us use, Covenant Eyes, that's where the name comes from. I've made a covenant with my eyes that I'm not going to put my eyes where my eyes shouldn't be on the internet. And if you want to get in on that, it's like, if you do it through the church, it's like $25 a year. You do it on your own, it's like $125 through the year. And the idea is, verse 4, that not only does God see our ways, but somebody else that gets a tracking report of what we visit online holds us accountable, has a conversation with something interesting shows up. Doesn't solve everything, obviously. There's three elements to our battle. There's the eyes, there's the heart, there's the hands. And we talk about that a lot in our More Than Conquerors ministry. Don't put your eyes where your eyes shouldn't be, but even if my eyes are closed, I've got a fantastic imagination, sadly. And lust really begins as a heart issue. How can I not covet? And even if the enemy manages to slip something by me, how can I keep my hands filled with good and godly things so that I don't reach for something that I shouldn't? He's not guilty of lust, he tells us. He's also not guilty of deceit. Verse 5, if I've walked with falsehood or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God might know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way or my heart walked after my eyes or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. Verse 8, he ends with an oath, and that's one of four that we're going to see in this section. This is very typical of courts in the ancient world who would ask you to prove that you're telling the truth by taking an oath, by pronouncing a curse that would fall on you if you're lying. Job is saying, look, if I'm lying, if I'm deceitful, if my thumb is on the scales, pull out all of my crops. Don't let me get any money for any of it. I'm not guilty of lust. I'm not guilty of deceit. Verse 9, I'm not guilty of adultery. If my heart has been enticed by a woman or if I've lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down over her. Another curse. Hey, if I'm sleeping around, let my wife be taken by another man and be a servant in his household. For that would be wickedness, adultery. Yes, it would be iniquity, deserving of judgment. That would be a fire that consumes to destruction and root out all my increase. Except I haven't done that. So that's not the explanation. Verse 13, I also have not abused my authority. I haven't lorded over the people that God has entrusted to me. Something that Gail Irwin talks to us about often when he's here. Lording over. I've despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me. What then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? That's a revolutionary statement for its time. Even in our time. What did Job just say? He's saying no one is born to serve another. There's no class of people, race of people, category of people that are born in servitude, that are born to be subservient to another. Jesus, of course, takes it a step further. He says, well, as the church, what we're born to do is to bow down and serve each other, to wash each other's feet. Guys who were at the men's retreat, we talked about that. Speaking of accountability, how's the question? Here's a question. We talked in small groups about washing feet. Talked about opportunities that we had while we were still at the retreat, but we also, most groups, I think, talked about, hey, what about when we get back with our families, at our workplace, with our friends, in the body of Christ? And we had some things we talked about under the category of foot washing. Did those things come back from Ark City with us? How are we doing on those? Verse 16, if I've kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail or eaten my morsel by myself so the fatherless could not eat of it, well, then I deserve to be punished, he says. But no matter what you say, here's another thing I haven't done. I haven't been cruel to the poor. Verse 18, from my youth I reared him as a father. From my mother's womb I guided the widow. And if I've seen anyone perish for lack of clothing or any poor man without covering, if his heart hasn't blessed me and if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I've raised my hand against the fatherless, the orphan in other words, when I saw that I had help in the gate, then let my arm fall from my shoulder. Let my arm be torn from the socket. Another curse. If I've walked by someone that I was in a position to help, rip my arm out of its socket, Lord. He's saying, I'm not guilty of greed or idolatry. For destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I can't endure. If I've made gold my hope or said to fine gold, you are my confidence. If I've rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much. If I've observed the sun when it shines or the moon moving in brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand. This also would be iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. If I gave myself credit for my wealth, or if I gave a sun god or a moon god credit for these blessings, yes, I would deserve everything that I'm experiencing and more, Job says. Except that I didn't, and I haven't, because I wouldn't. He also tells us that he's not guilty of taking vengeance or even having a vengeful spirit. If I've rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me or lifted myself up when evil found him, indeed, I've not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. He says, I'm also not guilty. On the list of things I'm not guilty of, add this, I'm not guilty of not extending hospitality. High virtue biblically, high virtue in Eastern culture. Verse 31, if the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? But no sojourner has had to lodge in the street, for I've opened my doors to the traveler. Hospitality is kindness to strangers. It's not having friends over for barbecue. But Job says, hey, anybody who was in town, if they were hungry, I fed them. If they needed a place to crash, I housed them. Verse 33, he goes on, he says, I'm not guilty of hypocrisy. If I've covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of family so that I kept silence and did not go out the door. Well, I didn't. I haven't lied about my sin. Haven't hidden my sin. I'm not like Adam who covered himself with fig leaves and tried to pretend everything was all right. Job is saying, I've never hidden anything from you, God. I think it's interesting. We live in a day where we're less and less able to hide things from people. I'm so divided on that. The libertarian in me is deeply, deeply committed to the right of privacy. The pastor in me says, knowing that absolutely everything you do on the internet is going to be public, already is, Facebook knows, Google knows, people who are willing to pay the money know, maybe that's an incentive to behave differently on the internet. Skip down to verse 38. Job has one more if I have. If I've counted right, there's 16 total. I bundled a few of them in the interest of time. But if you go back and count, I think there's 16 things that Job says, I haven't done. Verse 38, here's another. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I've eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives. In other words, if I've been a plantation owner abusing my servants or sharecroppers, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. 16, if I have, but I haven't statements. Four different curses that he's called down. Hey, if I'm guilty, then uproot my crops, take my wife, take my arm, take my land. Four different curses Job is confident he's not going to receive. Not that it matters much given everything that he already has received. But he says these four things won't happen. Just watch. These four things won't happen because these are 16 things I'm not guilty of. Pause. Pretty good self-assessment in chapter 31. If you're asking yourself, how's my walk? Here's a pretty good survey. Lust, deceit, dishonesty, adultery, lording over people, being charitable to the poor or not, greed, idolatry, vengeance, bitterness, hospitality, hypocrisy, mistreating anybody, family, friends, employees. Yeah, I don't think that's 16 again. Some are kind of doubled or bundled, but it's a pretty comprehensive list, isn't it? That's not a bad place to start praying. Lord, search my heart and see, is there any wicked way within me? And pray specifically on those bullet points. It's a pretty comprehensive list. And Job's point in sharing it with us is, Lord, whatever I've done, if it's on this list, I don't see it. If it's not on this list, I don't know about it. I've thought about everything I can think of, God, and you won't tell me what I'm missing. Oh, verse 35, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. If God presented me with explanation, Job says, charges, depositions, evidence, I'd cling to it. I'd be so happy for it. That's a good heart check right there. Challenge someone with something that might be hard for them to hear, an exhortation, a rebuke. They walk away. What's going to happen next? How did they receive it? Were they teachable? Did they thank you for taking the relational risk to speak a hard thing? Or did they immediately get defensive? Well, here's what you don't understand. But this is what she's doing. But you're not remembering. But what about yourself? Pull out the lumber of your own eye. Job is saying, hey, if God would actually rebuke me for whatever it is I'm being punished for, I would say thank you. I'm willing to listen, Job says. I would treasure a rebuke from God. I would cherish an explanation. But all I get is silence. What am I supposed to do? And with that, verse 40, the words of Job are ended. We're going to hear from him again, but it's going to be a little while because we have to hear from Elihu first and then from God. Remember the homework for next week. Read ahead. Who's Elihu? But before we get to our homework for next week, what's our takeaway from tonight? What do we take home from these three chapters? If God presented me with an explanation, I would cling to it, Job says. How many of us have said something like that at some point in our lives? I could endure this. I might even be grateful for this if God would just explain why it's happening. If only I could understand. Darkest nights I can remember since coming to Christ. I might be wrong, but some nights that stand out for me at least are the nights after my ex-wife left me. I was about a year and a half old in the Lord, and I spent night after night, I'd never really prayed before, crying out, why, God? I got saved. confessed my sin, stopped my sin, started reading the Bible, started trying to be a husband the way that you called me to be. Now she leaves me? She was within her rights before. I don't understand what's happening now. Explain. And God didn't. And the answer I got from brothers in the Lord at the time was, Patrick, you just need to have faith. These things happen for a reason. You just need to have faith. My response to that was pretty much Job's response. Why? Why do I need to have faith? Why should I have faith in a God who's allowing bad things to happen when I'm trying really hard to be good? Ironically, Job gives us the answer. He asks the question in chapter 31. He gave us the answer in chapter 29. Chapter 31, he says, "Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Oh, if I just could get some answers from God." The thing is, when we ask God to repeat himself, usually he doesn't. He's dignified that way. Job is asking God to answer a question that Job himself has already answered. Back in chapter 29, what did we read? The whole chapter was verse after verse of what? Blessings, right? Financial blessings, relational blessings, blessings of children, blessings of influence in the community, blessings of ministry, blessings and blessings and blessings and blessings. Where did they all come from? God, how do we know? Well, got a book here, Patrick. Yeah, but we also know because Job tells us. Verse 2, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when," what? "God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon me. By his light I walked through the darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me." Job knows. He tells us articulately, powerfully, poetically, God is the source of every good thing. Why have faith in God when he seems far away? Because there were a bunch of times that Job remembers that he wasn't. And in those times, he showed us he was good. "Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book." He did. We have a book that tells us all about him. But Job had a book written on the pages of his life. Job had a life full of pages upon pages of testimony, of blessings that prove who God is. That's where faith comes from. Evidence of things unseen. I don't see God right now. I can't hear God right now. God seems far away from me at this moment. How can I have faith that he's still there? Because he's shown me in the past who he is. He's told me he'll never leave me or forsake me, and he's proven it. Has he proven it to you? The reason I struggled as a young believer, I didn't have any experience with God. I didn't have my own testimony of God showing himself faithful again and again and again. So that was hard for me. I had his word and I had the evidence of other people. I didn't have my own story. Job had his own story. Most of us have our own story of God's faithfulness. The challenge is we forget. So the good old days are a function of bad memory and good imagination. Sometimes hard times are even harder because we have bad memory and bad inspiration. Sometimes we make hard times harder because we have no willingness to remember and believe who God is, who he's shown us to be again and again. We can believe he's faithful in the present and in the future because he's shown himself to be so good in the past. Flip over to Deuteronomy 8 with me. He's shown us this in our lives. He tells us this in his word. Deuteronomy 8, in my study Bible, there's a subheader that says, "Remember the Lord your God." Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe. Why? So that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, but fed you with manna, which you didn't know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Your garments didn't wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and fear him, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land. What did Moses just tell us? He said there were times in the desert that God seemed far away. There were times in the desert that were really, really hard. There were times in the desert when all of the people, including Moses, doubted. But God is saying in Deuteronomy 8, hey, true or false, Moses, I brought you through. Well, true. True or false, I use those times, those trials in the desert to prepare you for what's waiting on the other side of the Jordan. Well, true. True or false, you're walking in to the land that I promised your ancestors, believing that you're going to succeed because I haven't left you these last 40 years. Again and again in Deuteronomy, again and again through the Old Testament, God says, remember, 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 because that's where you're going to draw strength. And not remember just for the sake of remembering. I learned the other day a memorial service for a very close friend of mine is going to be in New Jersey in a few weeks, and the people planning it are coinciding with my college's reunion because they figure, well, people will be potentially back in town for reunions, and it'll be, I hate that. Because my college is obsessive about reunions, and people go back, not just every 10 years, every year people go back, because these were the best years of our lives. How sad. Another friend who passed away this past year, I came across his obituary, looking for my first friend's obituary, actually. And in his obituary, it said, he fondly remembers his college days with this friend and this friend and this friend and doing these things as the best years of his life. That's not the way it's supposed to be with college, with high school, with anything. Best years of our lives are supposed to be the ones that we're living, second only to the ones that we're about to live. School is supposed to prepare us for what's next. That's the way it is with God. God just told Moses in Deuteronomy 8, every trial we endure prepares us for the thing that God knows is next for us. That's how he works. 2 Corinthians 3:18, we're being transformed into Christ's image from glory to glory. God takes us from glory to greater glory to still greater glory until he brings us home to ultimate glory. That's what this life is supposed to be. How do we remember that? Community. Have a prayer partner, have a prayer group, so that when you forget God's faithfulness, somebody who knows your story, who's walked with you on your journey, can say, but remember when? Write your own notes, prayer journal, notes in your Bible, spending time with God in his word. Getting to know God as he reveals himself to us in his word, the way that he just did. Anything that helps us remember who God is, because there's gonna be times we won't see his hand. There are times we can't hear his voice, and there are a lot of times where we don't feel his presence. And usually those are the times that he's specifically preparing us for what he knows is next. And what's gonna get us through the next thing is remembering the last thing. And what got us through the last thing is remembering the thing before. And the thing before that God allowed in our lives to prepare us for the journey he knew was waiting. One more thing that can help us in those times is this book that God wrote. Look again at chapter 30. I'm not going to read anything. Just remind yourself what was there. All the trials, all the suffering, people mocking, wave after wave crashing down of abuse. Who could have spoken the words in chapter 30 besides Job? Jesus. Look again at chapter 31. Who could have spoken those words besides Job? If it worked the last time, try it again. Jesus. Jesus was innocent of those 16 things and more. And Jesus was subjected to every trial that Job was subjected to, and the four things that he would have been subjected to if God had brought those curses on him. Jesus on the cross couldn't see God. The Father turned his face away, right? Why did Jesus not cry out for a legion of angels to rescue him? Why did he not wipe out the Romans and the Jewish leadership along with them? Because he knew the trials he was experiencing. More than chapter 30 and 31 put together, he knew everything about the trials he was experiencing. He knew they were good. He knew God would make them profitable. And he knew they were absolutely essential for the ministry that God wanted to do next. How did Jesus know all of that? Because he knew God. Jesus was God. Jesus knew God. He was eternally intimate with the Father. There was nothing about God he didn't know. And so he knew and believed that what he was experiencing, God would use for good. We said last week, we misunderstand Psalm 22. When Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's not asking a question. He's pointing us to the answer. He's referencing Psalm 22. He's pointing us there. Because the end of the story is, when he cried to you, he heard. My praise shall be of you in the great assembly. Psalm 22, verse 25, I will pay my vows before those who fear him. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord. Why? Because of the cross. All the families of the nation shall worship before you because of the cross. The kingdom is the Lord's. He rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship because of the cross. All those who go down to the dust shall bow down before him. Even he who cannot keep himself alive, a posterity should serve him. It will be recounted of the Lord to the next generation. They will come and declare his righteousness to a people who haven't even been born yet that he's done this because of the cross. If you turn to Psalms, stay there because that's where we're going to end up. It's interesting. Something I forgot to point out. Job 31, 35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. The word for mark is ta. Ta is a letter. The closest equivalent in English is an X, except in Hebrew it's written like a cross. Here is my cross, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. How do we endure hard times? We do what Jesus did. We know God. Because the more we know God, the more we can remember of God. We watch God work in our lives. And we thank him, because the more we thank him, the more we connect the blessings that we're experiencing with the God who's bringing them, the more we remember God. We remember his faithfulness, not because we want to go back to those places and times, so that we remember that God has brought us through the less blessed times, the hard times, to prepare us for the next time. We remember that because God is good, what he's allowing in our lives, he'll work out for good. The next thing will be good. Why? Because the last thing was good. Psalm 77. As we close. Beginning in verse 7. Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? And so, Lord, we close our service trusting you to lead and guide, knowing that some of the places that you take us, some of the things that you allow in our lives are going to be hard. Some of them are going to hurt. Some of them we're really, really going to hate. But in all of them, Lord, you're either using us or preparing us, or usually both. And so we surrender. You know what's best. You know what's ahead. You know the ministry that you have for us, and you know who we're going to need to be to fulfill it. And so, Lord, we give you permission. Knowing how highly you regard our sovereignty, Lord, it blows our minds, but we need to surrender. And we choose to surrender. Lord, invade our lives with painful grace. Make us the people that you desire to use, to love people that you desire to use, to love people that you desire to be with you forever. In Jesus' name, amen.